children are also in favor of remote work for themselves as well. So that's right. To consider.
Do you think that we could encourage some of these kids to have a TikTok about never going back to school again?
Absolutely.
And I actually know what TikTok is what I was going to say. So. Which is impressive enough.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, even the parents are on there saying, hey, we're never going back.
That's great. Well, good. Well, again, as we say on COVID Noise Filter, we'll continue to follow with the story.
Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Greetings, I'm Ansel Craiglin.
And I'm Winston Watson.
And I'm Donna Clark.
And we are The Meditation.
We are listening to Community Radio.
KBOO
90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. Dig it.
Good evening, and welcome to Transpositive PDX here on KBOO Radio out of Portland, Oregon. Tonight, we're going to continue our theme of trans sex, love, and dating. We're going to continue with our special guest, Lucy Fielding. We opened a show a couple of weeks ago with her. And we're going to do a continuation of that. But Lucy Fielding is the author of an upcoming book. And it's a great book. It's titled Trans Sex, Clinical Approaches to Transsexualities and Erotic Embodiments. That's scheduled to be released on May 24th. It's published by Routledge. Now, Lucy Fielding is a resident in counseling, practicing in Charlottesville, Virginia. She received her master's in counseling psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute. And Lucy also holds a PhD in French from Northwestern University, where she specialized in 18th century literature, histories of sexuality, and erotic literature. Her background in literature and history attunes her to the many ways that image, metaphor, and cultural scripts shape and inform the narratives we carry with us as we move through the world, as well as how these narratives inscribe themselves on our bodies. Now, you can find out more about Lucy at lucyfielding.com, and that's LucieFielding.com.
Hi, I'm Emma Lugo. I use she and her pronouns, and just so thrilled to have Lucy Fielding on our show again. Hoping we can talk some more about trans sex, love, and dating tonight, along with lots of literary analysis.
I'm so excited for this.
Yay. So welcome, Lucy. And once again, I would like for you, if you would please, to model a particular behavior and locate yourself for us before we get into substance here.
All right. My name is Lucy Fielding. My pronouns are she, they. Please interchange them at will. And I am a white, queer, polyamorous, kinky, visibly able-bodied, Jewish, 43-year-old, non-binary trans femme. It's my pleasure to be invited back. This is such a privilege to talk to y'all. Thank you.
So for those that don't understand where that comes from, Lucy was just modeling for us something that she absolutely advocates in her advice to counselors, providers out there. In beginning to really frame a relationship with clients as they come to them for services.
Wouldn't it be so cool if, like, you're at a doctor's office and the nurse, without even missing a beat, you know, just says, "Hi, my name is X. My pronouns are Y." You know, like, and just, you know, and socially locates like that. That would be, it would be such a small thing, but like, such an incredible shift.
Well, yeah. In so many places, at least here in the Portland area, you know, at least pronouns is it's really gained traction, and most places that you go for services will at least have a name tag that, you know, displays that.
Thank goodness.
So with that, when we left off, Lucy, we had started to get into kind of the middle of the book, first part having, in my terminology, I said, laid out the playing field, described many of those dominant narratives that we continue to labor under, and that really set the context for at least think how things have been, and in many ways how they continue to be, but also are the bowling pins that are set up for you to begin to knock down in this middle part of the book, and how, you know, you go about that. And it's also the part of the book where we shift from that more outward facing setting of context to that inward facing, both as individuals and as a community piece, as we begin to explore our sexualities, I guess is a great way of saying it. So with that.
Yeah, our embodied eroticism, you know, finding pleasure in our bodies, and it's amazing how like revolutionary and liberatory, you know, just the very notion of recentering pleasure is in practice, because, you know, so much of what providers are trying to talk about is about function and about performance and about orgasm, and, you know, and that really limits what eroticism can be for folks. I think one of the pleasures and possibilities of queer and trans sex is the ability to just resist and refuse, and to say, you know, like, I'm not going to hold myself into this way of these dominant discourses, these hegemonic notions of like comportment and expression.
I was wondering if you could give us maybe a specific example or two of what you mean by liberating pleasure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what I, one example that I just, I talk about revisioning the embodied self, and it's revising a notion of what our bodies can do. Mirabelle Weather in her fabulous zine FTW talks about how, you know, like, our, no one can tell us besides ourselves what our bodies can do, what sex should be, and what bodies are for, what body parts are for. And so what I want to really, so like an example of this, you know, certainly we can engage in, you know, renaming parts, you know, so starting to redevelop a relationship to parts. And we have all sorts of wonderful creative names for our parts. We can throw out the scripts and say, like, you know, I am going to use my parts, but I'm going to use them differently. So a sex educator based in Philly, Jamie Joy, talks about, with oral sex, the difference between, you know, that there's kind of two models. There's bobbing and swirling. You know, it is a biological homolog to the glans clitoris. So why not interact with it as such? You can flick, you can swirl, you can do all sorts of things if you choose that you want to use those parts. Sometimes we may choose to, we may find ourselves faced with this idea that, like, oh, well, if I am a specific gender, then I should behave in certain ways, or sex should look in particular ways when I am engaging in it. So, you know, like the idea that, like, you know, if you're trans feminine, you can't top because that would be, or can't use, I call my parts my clit, can't use your clit penetratively. Again, like, if it feels good for you, please do that. You know, but it's really the intention and the energy that you bring to that interaction. You know, like, I was speaking to a friend the other day who recently had top surgery, and they lamented the fact that their partners were just, like, completely avoiding their chests. And they're like, you know, like, yeah, it's shifted, but, like, please interact with my chest, just don't interact with it in ways that that don't feel yummy to me, that we haven't discussed. You know, let's talk about how I want these parts interacted with. And then, like, there's also the possibility of just, like, decentering our genitalia and our breast or chest tissue entirely, And I use that word polymorphous perversity, but it basically means that any part of our bodies can be an erogenous zone, and so many ways can lead to pleasure in the body, like somebody stroking the nape of my neck in certain ways, or nibbling my earlobe can cause a tremendous amount of pleasure. Or if I'm being flogged, that was a real delight finding, so it doesn't have to always go the traditional route of we're just going to the cishet route that says, you know, that certain genitals do this and behave in certain ways, and we can just throw all of that out. Our bodies can be playgrounds. I think so often, and I know that I did this, that it was so easy for me to do this, especially at the beginning of my transition, to see like any kind of erotic experience as trying to avoid dysphoria. And instead, I'm trying to find like, how can I move towards euphoria? The mere avoidance of discomfort or distress is not going to do it for me. I need to feel gender good. I need to feel yummy in my body. I need to be seeking out ways that, to quote one of my favorite writers of erotica, Zan West, that my gender, that my body can be an elaborate sex toy.
That's
and folks in the disabled community have been doing this too. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we've all learned how to find pleasure in our bodies in some wondrous ways, some fabulous ways. We've learned to see our bodies as these incredible sex toys, and they've often gone through, you know, routes that are not necessarily sanctioned, between scare quotes, by dominant groups, but like, oh, there's so much pleasure to be had in our bodies. So this and not just sexual pleasure, but erotic pleasure.
There you go. And you do make those distinctions in the book very clearly, both outward looking and inward looking.
Yeah.
I think the way and there's passionate relationship and compassionate relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Compassionate being in touch with yourself.
Yeah.
And allowing yourself to explore. So, Lucy, if I may, one of the terminologies that you use in the book is flipping the script. And I think this last piece is a good segue to kind of exploring that, let's explore that.
Cool.
Because you do that so wonderfully in your book.
Yeah, like I think that's a really good example there to talk about like hormones again. You know, like and I'll take tea for example, because I talked about E for a little bit last time, but tea, the guidance is your libido is going to go through the roof, and as displayed to our collective horror in films, in TV shows like the original L Word, this idea that like suddenly, you know, you're going to take tea and become this rage beast, you know, and that desire is just going to be suddenly capacious, you know, and that, you know, one will be pulled without, you know, without even meaning to, into, you know, toxic masculinities. And that's just like, again, who says, you know, like, I think that we need to be looking at the language and the rhetoric that we're using, because if we're using certain terms, we are, you know, like the very word libido, you know, is a reference to the idea of, you know, drive theory, as sex is a drive, you know, and that plays into rape culture. So like, you know, if sex is a drive, then, you know, somebody can say, well, I just gotta have it, you know, like, and sex as a drive also limits us, because, you know, it's just like, it's an up down thing instead of, it's variable based on context, and dysphoria is a context, euphoria is a context. You know, these are important to talk about, you know, as just as important as like, you know, whether stress is a common concept, context that we talk about, that to which desire is often responsive. You know, and I think that the pandemic really has revealed those kind of like two camps. You know, there's like, there are those of us for whom, like, if I am stressed out, like, there's no way that I want to, that I feel thirsty or want to be, in my body, you know, like I just not gonna happen. And then there are those of us, you know, who are like, oh God, stress is what is a driver of desire for me, you know, and so it makes it, it adds a spiciness to it, and so eroticism, sensuality, sex, play can discharge some of the that feeling of pent up frustration. So
I guess maybe I want to bridge to another kind of topical or thematic piece here. Mm-hmm. And that is getting the rocks out of the backpack in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma processing. I did note in reading the book that you do cite Bessel van der Kolk's mm-hmm. work, which I'm familiar with. So that
Rasma Menakem's My Grandmother's Hands is another one that I just absolutely love.
Any number. I mean, you really have. At any rate, what we're driving at with this, folks, is what I'm going to call almost like a prerequisite of at least addressing, if not fully processing, you know, our traumas, before we can be in touch with our bodies in a way that allows some of these approaches.
Yeah, I mean, I think I really wanted to start from this sense that we may want to be in touch with, come into passionate relationship with our embodied sexual self. Sounds great. Sounds fabulous. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like there are those rocks in our backpack. And so, you know, for some of us, like there's going to be some ambivalence around that. Like it feels scary. It feels risky. And so, I think it's important to note what I lay out in my model is not itself a trauma modality. It's a trauma-informed modality. And so what I am So one thing I very much caution is the idea that, like, you may find that you need to do some, you know, more intensive trauma processing within, like, you know, before kind of going on this journey. But there's also this, what I really want to think about too is that I think we sometimes labor under this discourse of safety, you know, that, like, and this is especially prevalent in most of the trauma modalities, that, like, well, you can't really engage in trauma processing unless you feel safe. And how many of us feel safe all the time? How many of us have access to safe? How many of us are, you know, can expect to feel safe in a, you know, within a carceral system of justice, within, you know, within white supremacy, within, you know, a, within capitalism. I mean, I live in the rural South. There's a wonderful tradition of Appalachian queerness, so rich. And you know, like, every few months there's a whole bunch of neo-Confederate flaggers who, you know, decide that they're going to walk down the street. And so, like, yeah, I don't feel safe a lot of the time. And so what I wanted to try to shift is the idea that safety isn't the goal. A feeling of safety shouldn't be the goal. That's too much to ask. It's safety is a gendered, classed, raced concept. And this is pointed out, by the way, by Kai Ching Tom, who in I Hope We Choose Love, and then she did a fabulous set of tweets and Instagram posts about this over the summer. But, like, you know, like, let's get away from safety. And so what I propose is that, like, that safety is too high of a standard. It's an unattainable standard. So why don't we go for a sense of boundedness? And again, I turn to kink as a kind of guiding metaphorical system, as it were, you know, which is, you know, in kink, we operate under principles like RAC, risk-aware consensual kink, and PRIC, personal responsibility in consensual kink. And both assume that, you know, risk is inherent in what we're doing. Everything we do will involve risk. It's not possible to be, you know, 100% safe. And so let's just throw that out the window. And so, like, what if we're approaching things from a risk-aware standpoint, and what we're doing is we're trying to just, like, increase capacity as providers to tolerance for risk, you know, to take that leap together. And it really is a leap together, because I want to think about, you know, that when I say, like, coming into compassionate relationship, it's that we are sitting with, we are holding space with, we're not holding space for. We are not caring for, we are caring with our clients and patients. And we're just in it with them. And I think that, again, the pandemic has really changed so much of how I work. And I wrote the second half of the book during the pandemic, you know, in kind of, like, wrestling. How do I hold this? I am not okay. How do I hold this? How do I find my body, my way back to my body again? I'm a survivor of two sexual assaults in, you know, April and May 2018. And, you know, again, how do I find my way back to my body? And I think for me, it was this feeling of like, we're just going to be two humans in a room. We are, you know, there is, and we're just sitting with one another, and we are making space for the feelings, the thoughts, the sensations, the images that might be too scary to be faced alone. And when we can create that kind of space of giving permission to be in it, to have emotionally transformative experiences, then we can experience that, we can internalize that, and we can feel it ourselves, and we can be our own containers.
It's time for the KBOO Spring Pledge Drive. Did you know KBOO is 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland? KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, people. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free thanks to the support we receive from our members. 80% of our funding comes from our members. You can donate today by clicking Donate in the mobile app, texting KBOO to 44-321, or you can mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8 Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. The best way is to go to kboo.fm/give. Less than 10% of listeners are members of KBOO. So won't you consider donating today at kboo.fm/give? Thank you.
Wow, thank you. I think you got at what I was asking for there.
I'm so glad.
Oh my goodness. Back to Emma, who was kind of asking for, you know, more practicum, you know. Yeah. I think
one of the things that I talk about is like swan diving into the awkward. Like let's feel what it is to you know, to just like give up on the idea that of performance, and that, you know, like we need to conform to certain roles. Another thing is slowly kind of learning to attune to bodily awareness. One of the tools that I talk about in the book is something that a friend of mine told me about, and they refer to it as feels good yes and feels bad no. The story that I tell in the book is this is a friend who was going through a rough time of it at a certain point, and you know, and really couldn't really do a whole lot of expression of, you know, really complex interaction, you know, very much in a trauma space, and so, you know, came up with this idea, like I can check in with myself and get like this visceral hit, feels good yes, feels bad no, and like you don't have to have a ton of bodily awareness for that. Like if somebody if somebody puts patchouli under my nose, I am going to say feels bad no, get that away from me, I hate that scent. Like I'm just going to like recoil from it. And that's some information, like that's what no feels like in our body. It's a visceral thing. Yes is like, you know, like if you say like, hey, would you like to have pizza tonight? My answer is always or nearly always going to be yes for that. Pizza's a love language. So like, feels good, yes, let's go get some pizza. Let's negotiate on toppings now. So feels good, yes, is a way of kind of building in that embodied awareness. And then, you know, really, I think there's a lot of learning about the fact that we're entitled to desire, to pleasure. There's so much in the larger cultures in which we move that say that we are not entitled to desire, that we shouldn't take up too much space, that we're a burden, that, you know, like, and that's just, we are all entitled to pleasure and to having erotic experiences that are feels good, yes, and that are gender good, to bring that term back. Again, thank you, River, for coming up with that, because it's brilliant. And so, you know, how can we figure out what wanting feels like in our body? How do we feel what pleasure feels like in our bodies? We could do that for so many ways. We can experiment. You know, the one of the classic things is to, you know, is the mirror test. You know, is just alone. You know, like, try out different sex toys. You know, and get creative with sex toys. Like in the kink community, we have pervertibles. You know, like, you take a rug beater and you can use it as an impact implement or a wooden spoon or whatever. You know, like, there's a sex educator, Corey Moore, who talks about like the We Vibe chorus, and, you know, says like, it may have been marketed towards like cishet couples, but this toy is so versatile. So like, you know, like, you can play around with it and like put it in your strap, or like use it, adjust it so that it becomes a butt plug. There are all sorts of ways, like, just because you can use the off-label uses of these toys, the off-label uses of your body. You know, you don't need the FDA to tell you like what is an acceptable use of toys and your body. Just go off-label, and it will be, you'll be glad you did. Our bodies can do so much. And you know, to get back to this notion of coming into passionate relationship that I talked about last time, getting out from under the idea that like, we know what our bodies can do. You know, there's so much that is untapped. The sexological body worker, Betty Martin, who's based in the Pacific Northwest, just came out with her new book, On the Wheel of Consent, talks about, you know, like, hands as these magnificent things, you know, and usually we use hands instrumentally to grasp or to give pleasure or to give something to somebody. Why not think of them as the pleasure receptors that they are, the ways of taking pleasure and enjoying pleasure, because they have as many nerve endings as our lips and our genitals. There's so much there. There's nothing, and kink and tantra and breathing and all of it is available to us. And we don't even need hormones or surgeries to make that possible. Like, I figured out I could have access to this before I even started taking E for the first time. We can find that polymorphous perversity in our bodies.
One of the notes that I have is, and it's my own phrasing, you know, gender dysphoria versus body dysphoria.
Okay. Yeah. So so at least in terms of the DSM-5, gender dysphoria is the distress, the feelings of unease, the that one experiences in when one's when one is not affirmed, or in one's gender, and when one is when one's gender expression does not align or is congruent with one's gender identity. Body dysphoria, otherwise referred to as body dysmorphia, is about like a feeling of distress that is centered on a particular part of the body. So like, you know, where and so for a lot of us, a lot of trans and non-binary folks, we may experience gender dysphoria and also body dysphoria. So a body around like our genitals or our chest or breast tissue. And so that's part of that that feeling of like, oh God, I've got to shift how others are interacting with this part, or I've got to find ways to change either change it through hormone therapies or surgical options of various types.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then I guess we're going to need to, you know, try to bring this down to some sort of a logical conclusion.
Yeah.
If there is such a thing. Like I said, I think in the opening of the first show, I think the title of your book maybe kind of falls a little short.
Yeah.
Of the scope and expansiveness of your project here. It's, I don't know, it opened me up to some thoughts and processes that I had thought I had transcended years ago, frankly. Mm. And I've got a few years on you.
You know, I'm so glad that the book resonated with you. I mean, yes, it's written for a provider audience. And this is another Betty Martin question. She asks, who is this for? And I write this in the introduction, but like it may be written in the language of a professional provider audience, but it's not for them. It's for us. It's for trans and non-binary and gender expansive folks, for us to, you know, have touch our lineage and use our lineage to dream a future, fabulous queer future, a fabulous trans future, And that's what I really, it's that my hope is that this is for me an act of service. And I really appreciate all the lovely things you've said about me and the book and the model. But, you know, like we haven't even touched on the 14 incredible contributors to this book in chapter 6.
Oh, yeah.
Who have, you know, and I also want to just say, like, I hope that I really always want to recognize that, like, this is maybe among the first words, but it shouldn't be the last, and it won't be the last, because people are going to find things in my book that don't sit with them, you know, or that they want to expound upon, or that they want to take in a completely different direction. And I'm really excited for that. I hope that this book is an invitation to just to play and to dream and to fight and to resist and to claim our polymorphous, perverse playground of wonder bodies.
Yay. Oh, yay. Yes. It's
that was a great round.
It's right. It's not a how-to book. Exactly. It's not. I mean, it's opening up a dialogue. It's opening up visions. It's and I do want to I think point to our listeners that this is not a single author book per se. You know, that Lucy has invited in, you said, you know, you have like 14 contributors. Mm-hmm. And give us an example. You know, I mean, tell us, I mean, the scope of the of these, I mean, these aren't other, you know, necessarily all professional, you know, therapists or anything. Oh, no.
There's, there are folks who come from ancestral healing traditions, because a lot of us access, you know, our experience of gender and our relationship to sexuality and gender and our bodies, you know, comes through those traditions. You know, I want to engage pelvic floor PTs. So there are two pelvic floor PTs who, one example is that...
Tell the audience what you mean by PT. They may not.
Oh, a physical therapist, a pelvic floor physical therapist. Yeah, sorry. So one of them, Heather Edwards, who's based in Asheville, North Carolina, has these great like crotch coloring books, and so her contribution, one of the two contributions she made, was to create this activity where she let us use two pages, coloring pages from her coloring books, and, you know, as just like a way to like fancifully reimagine, you know, revision our parts, and so that's really fun. There's Red Viazad and Ignacio Rivera, two brilliant sex educators based in Baltimore, you know, have this incredible reflection on gender play and kink. And let me tell you, like, the first two paragraphs are the hottest thing I have read in a provider text ever. I have never been turned on by a provider's words, and oh my God, there it is. So it's really amazing. You know, the book ends with a beautiful, breathtaking essay by Laura Jacobs.
I concur. Yes.
Yeah. And so, like, there's so much packed in there, and I feel so privileged to have worked with those 14 amazing providers. Yeah, I could not have done that without them. I could not have done this project also without you know, even some cis providers like Portland-based Angie Gunn, you know, who is just fabulous and is a dear friend. And you know, this book arises out of, you know, some brainstorming conversations with her. So like, it takes a village to create this kind of work. And I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Well, Lucy, I think we're at a point where we're going to need to bring a close to this. So once again, tell us or tell the listeners, you know, where, how they can find your book, where, how they can find more information about you, because you are not just a therapist and an author, you're a speaker.
Sure. So my website, lucyfielding.com, you know, I do a lot of provider workshops, but I really, what I love more than anything are community-centered events, you know, that, like, about sexual communication, for example. And so one of the things that I'm conspiring with a few of the providers on is doing some panel discussions for community that's just like, you know, different voices and different perspectives, and, you know, and I might moderate it, but, like, you know, I really just want to turn it over to them and to to, like, let people ask all the questions that they, that their heart desires. So you can get the book from really.
Yes, sir. You know, there's one last thing that I wanted to point our listeners to, in addition to our conversation, because I found your discussion with, and correct me if I'm pronouncing Alex's last name wrong, with Alex Iantafi.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Iantafi, that's I-A-N. T-A-F-F-I. And it's found, it's a podcast, and it was a conversation that Lucy had. Alex is another sex therapist.
And a brilliant author.
Yes.
Like Gender Trauma is their latest book. They did a self-care workbook with Meg John Barker. They're hero of mine.
That conversation is comprehensive. I think it's great, and I want to point our listeners to that source as well, which is all, you know, lowercase gender stories, no space, dot buzz, b-u-z-z, sprout, sprout.com. I think other references, season 4, episode 47. That's genderstories.buzzsprout.com, season 4, episode 47. Highly recommend, you know, pulling that one up, downloading it, listening to it. Lucy, I want to keep talking to you. I hate to end this.
We have to end somewhere, but
we do.
You know,
we do.
You have my email, so, you know, use it. Let's keep talking.
Yeah. So I'll just end by saying thank you, Emma. Any last words?
Yeah, you know, Lucy, I don't know if you're interested in this, but I've been looking for a long time, like, to do a series. A podcast with someone, like, where we talk in, like, a lot of detail about transsexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't find anything even like now on the web, like where people actually get into the specifics. And we didn't do that on this show because this is a FTC nonprofit show, so we can't do that. And but I would love to do I've been looking for some people to do podcasts with who would be interested in talking about that. I don't know if that's something you'd be interested in, because it's like there's so many questions that like trans folks don't get any kind of answers to. Like when I transitioned, nobody explained anything to me about, you know, how to come or how to have an orgasm, mm-hmm. or really how to have pleasure after I'd had surgery. And so I had to figure it all mm-hmm. out on my own. And there wasn't really a lot of resources online for that, for like post-op trans women. Like, yeah. I don't know, I guess there was just this assumption that either you knew or, you know, your man was going to teach you or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Like,
uh-huh. Somehow, Emma, I think it's like a rite of passage thing. It's like everyone has to discover, you know?
For all of us, and there's all different ways in which like trans and non-binary and gender fluid bodies are like, you know, finding new ways of reclaiming and expressing pleasure and understanding how to really have joy with their bodies. And I'd love to do a series of podcasts with someone who, or we, you know, or with people, like mostly from like our trans positive collective, but with other people, where we could kind of get into the weeds. Like we really couldn't do that today, but I'd like to get into the weeds a little bit.
I'd love that. And you know, I'd love to be in a position to take like to take questions from community. You know, I think that would be really powerful for me.
I think like, that's really important.
I would love that. Yeah, because again, it's like, it's for cis folks, it's for trans folks. It's like we can all find ways to find pleasure and delight in our bodies. So yeah, let's keep talking. I'm so there for it. Yeah. So let's do it.
You know, you have been so gracious to us as a nonprofit, because you know, I'm sure you don't spend whole afternoons, early evenings for free, you know? And, you know, I have no idea how I could ever thank you enough, except to say, I hope it was good for you.
It was so good for me. This is really, as I told Alex.
It was
Alex,
so good for me. Oh my God.
Good. Let's process afterwards. Let's some fun aftercare. I think that this is so important. And like as I told Alex when we finished recording, you know, when I realized that when I was on their podcast, that was the first time that I had been interviewed by another trans person, and it was just like it's so much more meaningful. I love talking to cis folks, they're fine, they're great, but like this is meaningful. This is what I live for. It really was such a fabulous experience. And yeah, like I just want to keep talking. So thank you so much for reaching out. I'm always here.
It's past supper time at your place. I know that.
Yes, it is.
Namaste.
Thank you. Until next time.
Thank you.
There will be a next time. See ya.
Awesome. See ya.
Bye.
It's time for the KBOO Spring Pledge Drive. Did you know KBOO is 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland? KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, people. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free thanks to the support we receive from our members. 80% of our funding comes from our members. You can donate today by clicking Donate in the mobile app, texting KBOO to 44-321, or you can mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. The best way is to go to kboo.fm/give. Less than 10% of listeners are members of KBOO. So won't you consider donating today at kboo.fm/give? Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Tune in to KBOO.